Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and Decoder is my podcast about big ideas and other problems. We're doing something a little different today that I'm very excited about. We have a special episode with an interview by platformer editor and Verge co-conspirator Casey Newton. Hey, Casey.
Hey, Neil I. Thanks for letting me crash your podcast.
So, Casey, you interviewed Nick Clegg, who is the VP of Global Affairs at Facebook. He's a former member of the UK Parliament and Deputy Prime Minister. That's a lot of titles, a lot of history. How did your interview with Nick come about?
So this morning, Clegg posted a 5,000-word op-ed on Medium where he sets about trying to take apart the biggest criticisms that get leveled at Facebook, everything from it's too polarizing, it's spreading misinformation and hate speech, and it's just sort of showing people terrible things and fraying the fabric of society. And so he goes through those arguments, pushes back against them, and then unveils some changes Facebook is making to give you as a user more control over things. There's going to be a new feed slider that will let you decide if you want to see your feed in reverse chronological order, for example, or you can create a new feed called Favorites that just shows you your very favorite people and pages on Facebook. So it's kind of a philosophical shift for the company, trying to get away from pure algorithms crafted in secret in Menlo Park to something that you and I have more control over.
That is a big shift, but it also feels like it's re-characterizing some of the controls that are already there.
That's right. This is putting a fresh coat of paint on some things that they have done before, but they are signaling that there are going to be more of these things to come. I think they've gotten the message that no one trusts the algorithms that they make. And so one thing they can do about that is letting you get rid of the algorithms to the extent that you want to.
As I listened to the conversation, one question I really wanted to ask you to kind of frame it and contextualize it is that Facebook is very big, and you're going to listen to the conversation between you and Nick that kind of touches on this directly. Facebook's product doesn't express Facebook's corporate values. It expresses a different kind of value. Maybe it's neutrality, maybe it's connecting people, but there's a tension there that is a function of Facebook's size, right? Facebook can't just be one thing for a small group of people. It has to be everything for everyone.
That's right. Like most digital media publications just kind of get to pick a lane and have a fully developed worldview and pick and choose what people see based on that. That's not what Facebook is. Facebook is designed to be a free and open marketplace for all people. That's the business. That's the whole idea. And it does lash them to this kind of strained neutrality, which causes them to contort themselves in all sorts of strange ways sometimes. But one of the things that, you know, we explore in this talk is the way that Facebook has been dragged away from that neutrality, you know, putting in these information centers into the newsfeed that will tell you actual true facts about climate change and COVID-19 and how to vote. So this is, to me, one of the more interesting changes that Facebook is embarking on, is this move away from, you know, a strict view that, you know, whatever people say on Facebook is true.
Okay. Platformer's Casey Newton with Nick Clegg, VP of Global Affairs at Facebook. Here we go.
Well, Nick Clegg, welcome to Decoder.
It's great to be with you.
So you've just published a 5,000-word essay that pushes back on a lot of recent criticism of Facebook and makes some news about what the company is doing in response. Tell me about the origin of this piece.
Well, look, I'm not a technologist or an engineer by background. I'm a sort of refugee from politics, from 20 years in politics, and yet I've been at Facebook now for a couple of years. And so as a relative newcomer, I've been observing the debate, particularly, but not only in the US, the debate about the role of social media in society, in some of the most, you know, complex issues we have in politics, in culture, in a lot of the sort of social dynamics going on right now. And this was certainly not designed to simply act as a sort of receptacle for all the counter arguments. What I'm trying to do, and some people may believe I've succeeded, others no doubt will say that I haven't, but I've tried to engage sincerely and as thoughtfully as I can with many of the criticisms, precisely because I sometimes worry that the dialogue between Silicon Valley and the critics of Silicon Valley is becoming a bit of a kind of shouting match where people are just kind of yelling alternative views of the same facts and not really listening to each other. It's a genuine attempt to try and grapple with them. And the more I thought about this, I thought one of the things that was underlying a lot of the legitimate concern about social media in particular is, given that social media's early promise was all about empowerment, empowering individuals to have a voice they didn't have before, empowering communities to mobilize in a way that they didn't have before, empowering people to connect with families and friends in a way that they had before. And in Facebook's case, doing also all that on such a huge scale, and everybody, you know, because it's paid for by ads, doing so for free, I thought one of the really key issues to look into was, so, right, kind of who really is in charge? Is the user in charge or is the system in charge? And there's a lot of legitimate concern these days that somehow people's choices are not sovereign. They're not in the driving seat. That somehow in the boiler room, the algorithmic boiler room, all sorts of choices are being made, and some of them might be nefarious choices. They're not transparent enough. And so that's why I really homed in on this piece about how can we lift the veil a bit, you know, open the bonnet, look into the boiler room, be more transparent about how the systems work, and crucially, push forward with a renewed attempt at giving users meaningful controls, where in effect they can, in some instances, override the algorithm, override the ranking systems that are made available to them, and make their own choices.
And this is, you know, gets into sort of what is the news that you are making here. And I think to your point, there has been a huge amount of concern about what algorithms are doing in the background. Most of us are, we're not math majors or computer science majors. And so there is some sort of fear and uncertainty about what's going on in the background. And so one of the things that Facebook is now doing is giving us some new ways to change up what we see in the newsfeed. So what are some of these new controls?
Yeah, so some of the controls are old. I mean, we've had them for a while, but we're just going to make them a lot more prominent. So, for instance, you could always switch to a chronological feed, but candidly, it wasn't easy for people to find. So we're now going to have a sort of feed filter bar. When you scroll to the top of your feed, it'll be there. It'll always be there. And you can toggle between the feed as it currently exists to have it chronologically ordered, or crucially, and this is new, so that you can create actually your own new feed of favorites, a favorite sort of, you know, favorite groups, friends, posts, and so on. And you'll be able to curate that, if you like, for yourself and toggle between those three, the feed as it is, the chronological feed, and your new favorites feed in a much, much more effortless way. It'll be much more visible. It'll be visible there when you scroll to the top of your feed. There are other new controls as well, which I'm announcing this week. You'll be able to curate much more, with much greater granularity than before, who can comment on your posts. And that is something which wasn't available before. And we're also going to extend something which has existed for ads, for instance, and for connected content, namely, why am I seeing this? So you can go to the three dots and you can see, why am I seeing this ad? We're now going to extend that to suggested content. So when something is suggested to you, that cooking video, you can go on the three dots and you can see why you're seeing that. So I think collectively it's a start. I'm not going to pretend that those changes in and of themselves will lift all the questions that people have about how social media operates and how they interact with Facebook. But I do feel that they are significant steps in a better direction, putting users more in charge, being more open and transparent about things. And we will follow up with a number of additional steps, greater transparency, greater controls in the months to come.
And is that also a suggestion that maybe this is the beginning of this feed filter bar that you're introducing, that might have more filters that come to it over time? Like, is the idea that users will have sort of more and more control over how the stuff they see is ranked?
Yeah. I mean, look, in an ideal world, you just want to push ever more forcefully in a direction where people can personalize their feeds. And, you know, if people want to see more or see less of particular, you know, forms of content from particular pages or groups, there is also conceptually, at least, the possibility of exploring whether people can or can't, if you like, turn the dial up or down on particular classes of content. That's exactly the kind of work that we want to do. And now, exactly how granular, exactly which dials apply to which kinds of content, all of that still needs to be filled in. But that is very much the direction we're going in.
So the conventional wisdom about how the feed works now, I think for a lot of folks, and certainly of the folks who are most critical of Facebook, is that it rewards the most polarizing and outrageous content. And this is something that you really take on in this piece and push back against. I suspect if there's one sentence in your piece that the most people will take issue with, it's when you write, Facebook's systems are not designed to reward provocative content. You know, at the same time, when we look at lists of pages that get the most engagement, it does tend to be pages that seem to be pushing really polarizing content. So how do you reconcile this at Facebook?
Well, I mean, firstly, I of course accept that we need to just provide more and more data and more evidence about, you know, what is the specific content that is popular on newsfeed. And of course, although Facebook's critics often talk about sensational content dominating newsfeed, of course, we want to show, as I think we can, that many of the most popular posts on newsfeed are lighthearted. They're feel-good stories. We want to show people that the overwhelming majority of the posts people see on newsfeed are about pets, babies, vacations, and similar, and not incendiary topic. In fact, I think on Monday the most popular posts I think in the US was of a mother bear with some three or four baby cubs crossing a road. I saw it myself. It's lovely. I strongly recommend you look at it. And I think we can and we will do more to substantiate that. But beyond that, I do think, and I do try to grapple with this as thoroughly as is possible in a 5,000 word piece. Firstly, the signals that are used in the ranking process are far more complex, are far more sophisticated, and have far more checks and balances in it than are implied by this sort of cardboard cutout caricature that somehow we're just spoon feeding people incendiary, sensational stuff. It really, and I won't, I mean, happy to go into the details if you like, but there are thousands of signals are used, literally from the device that you use to the groups that you're, you know, members of and so on. We use survey evidence. We're using more and more survey evidence. We'll be doing more of that in the future as well to ask people what they find most meaningful. There's been a big shift in recent years anyway to reward content that is more meaningful, your connections with your families and friends, rather than stuff that is just, you know, brutally, sort of crudely engaging, you know, pages from politicians and personalities and celebrities and sports pages and so on. So that shift has already been underway. But in terms of incentives, this is the bit that I no doubt Facebook has, you know, maybe we have not been articulate enough in this. But firstly, the people who pay our lunch don't like their content next to incendiary, unpleasant material. And if you needed any further proof of that, this last summer, a number of, you know, major advertisers boycotted Facebook because they felt we weren't doing enough on hate speech. We're getting much, much better at reducing the prevalence of hate speech. That, you know, the prevalence of hate speech is now down to, what, 0.07%, 0.08% of content on Facebook. So every, what, you know, every 10,000 pieces of content you see, 7 or 8 might be. I wish it was down to 0. I don't think we'll ever get it down to 0. So we have a massive incentive to do that. But also, if you think about it, if you're building a product which you want to survive for the long term, where you want people in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years to still be using these products, there's really no incentive for the company to give people the kind of sugar rush of kind of artificially polarizing content which might keep them on board for 10 or 20 minutes extra. Now we want to solve for 10 or 20 years, not for 20 or 10 or 20 extra minutes. And so I don't think our incentives are pointed in the direction that many people assume. That all being said, it is of course true. It's just, I mean, you know, any sub-editor of a newspaper will tell you that, you know, it's why tabloids have used striking imagery and you know, cage-rattling language on their front pages since time immemorial. There are, of course, emotions of fear, of anger, of jealousy, of rage, which, of course, provoke emotional responses. They've done so in all media, in all time. And so, of course, emotive content provokes an emotive reaction amongst people. We can't reprogram human nature, and we don't want to deny that, which is why our CrowdTangle tool actually elaborates on that and shows how things are being engaged. But as you know, there is a world of difference between that which is most engaged with, in other words, where comments and shares are most, you know, most common, and actually the content that most people see. And that's quite different. And actually, if you look at what most human beings see, if you look at eyeballs rather than comments and shares, you get a quite different picture. And the final point I would make is, I think it really is, I read, you know, almost on a daily basis, words that like awash, a drowning in, all these euphemisms. You know, let's just keep this in perspective. In political content, if you read a lot of political commentary, you'd think that the only thing people go to Facebook for is not for babies, barbecues and bar mitzvahs, but for politics. In fact, politics is a minority of the content. It's about 6% of the total content on Facebook. So I guess my plea is, yes, we on Facebook need to be more open about all these different subtleties, but equally I think people who comment on it should keep some sense of perspective as well about what normal human beings in the normal world actually do when they go on Facebook.
So there's a tension in that I want to ask about. In your essay and in this discussion, you've talked about, you know, your belief, Facebook's belief, that people should have a lot of agency over what they see. They should get to choose who they want to hear from, which articles they want to read, which friends they want to hear from. At the same time, Facebook has taken steps to reduce the default amount of political content in the feed, to stop recommending political and civic groups, and really sort of exercising, you know, what some might call editorial judgment over at least what the defaults are. So are those two ideas at odds? Is that just a tension that you have to manage?
I think it is a tension. And as I say in the piece, you know, waxing lyrical about promoting individual agency, that's the easy bit. I mean, you know, that's mother and apple pie. I actually think also identifying harmful content and keeping it off the internet, that's challenging, but we're getting better at it, and we, you know, and it's doable. The bit that is really, really tough, because it's just the subject of so many differences of opinion, is what is the collective good? What constitutes the collective good? And who should determine that? And how should it be reflected on social media, which in many ways has become the public square for a lot of these things? And of course, that's particularly acute, or has been in recent years in the US, where there just isn't a ready-made, oven-baked consensus on what constitutes good content. You know, For one school of thought is bad and unacceptable content, is for another school of thought, you know, the right to free expression. And we're caught in the middle of that. We have heavy responsibilities to try and draw the lines in the right place. We do that as deliberately and deliberatively as we possibly can with academics and experts. We publish all of that quite openly. We enshrine that in our community standards. But at the end of the day, I do think it's something which I know Mark Zuckerberg feels very strongly himself. It's not great to have private companies basically adjudicating on what are societal and, in the end, quintessentially political judgments, where you're making judgments about where the collective good lies. And whilst it's difficult, I do think we need to move gradually. And when I say we, I mean both the private sector and the politicians and the legislators who are democratically accountable to the people. I do think we all sort of collectively need to move beyond admiring this problem or shouting this problem and trying to promulgate rules which enjoy wider consensus. Because it, in the end, I don't think anyone is going to accept, and why should they, is ever going to accept the rules as constituted by a private company itself.
So one of the ways that Facebook would talk about this 3 or 4 years ago was that there was a range of subjects about which it would say, well, we don't want to be arbiters of truth. That is not for Facebook to decide, for some of the reasons that you just mentioned. But in recent years, the company has introduced what it calls information centers. It's offered really high quality information about elections, COVID-19, I think climate change is the most recent one. Really sort of, you know, using its editorial discretion as a private company to say, we think this information is really good and you should see it. So I'm curious, what explains that change? Is the company getting more comfortable taking what look to me like editorial stances?
The only distinction I'd make, Casey, is it's not so much that Facebook is using its own editorial judgment. What we are recognizing is that Facebook just has exceptional reach. It is a means by which you can reach an exceptionally large number of people in a very, very direct way. And so we want to make that means, if you like, available to those who do legitimately promulgate and, if you like, editorialize authoritative information. So whether it's the CDC and the WHO on COVID, whether it is, you know, the UN-backed panel of international scientists on climate science, whether it is the public authorities running, you know, our elections. So it's not that we are seeking to supplement their role as the source of editorially authoritative information. What we're making ourselves available for is to then serve as the means by which that can reach a lot of people in a very direct way. And I guess what has clearly happened is that, I mean, the pandemic is the most dramatic example. But I think, you know, the US elections were another one, just given quite how polarized the politics leading up to the US elections were last November. I just think the company is recognizing that there are these societal issues which are all encompassing, and where there are institutions and organizations and experts and authorities who have, you know, pretty unimpeachable credibility. And we would like to connect the two. You know, we'd like to connect people with that. They, you know, people can choose to listen to it or not. As you know, on the COVID information hub, I think over 2 billion people accessed it. And I think over 600 million people double clicked on to, you know, to find more information on COVID. And on the voter information hub, it appears to have helped over 4.5 million Americans to register to vote who otherwise wouldn't. So I would draw this distinction between the words you used of editorializing, which I think is we're not trying to replace the CDC and the WHO. We're not trying to replace the climate change scientists who know their business in a way that Facebook does not.
Right. I mean, the thing that I appreciate about these moves is, you know, in all of the discussion around misinformation, I think there is an idea that if social networks would simply remove all of the bad posts, we'd be fine. But I think in reality, you have to show people good posts too. So to me, like, those kinds of information centers are a step in that direction.
Yeah. And look, it's two sides of the same coin. Of course, you need to bear down on misinformation. But you're never going to create a healthy information ecosystem on really difficult issues like public health and the pandemic simply by playing whack-a-mole on misinformation. You've got to, I mean, I would argue, actually, in many respects, what you proactively do to empower people with the right information is as important, if not more important, than that which you remove or demote. And candidly, on misinformation, I mean, you know, the pandemic is a classic example. We have governments saying that they do or don't like that vaccine. You know, I just read overnight that Canada has paused the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine for people under the age of 55. And suddenly you go, wow, is that something, you know? And then people pass comment on the Chinese vaccine and the Sputnik vaccine. And then people want to, of course, share on social media their personal experiences. My arm is sore, I've got a headache or whatever. We cannot, and nor should we, cleanse the internet of legitimate debate. And in fact, people expressing their opinions about the vaccines is a really important iterative process by which people become comfortable with taking the vaccine themselves. You don't tackle vaccine hesitancy by simply trying to, you know, eliminate all debate. So we you know, you're quite right. These things go hand in glove. It's both the information that you don't allow or you demote, but it's also crucially the information that you promote in a more proactive way, so that people have access to authoritative information in hopefully the most credible form that it can be delivered to them.
You're listening to a special episode of Decoder with Casey Newton and Facebook's Nick Clegg. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll hear Casey ask Nick about his thoughts on whether polarization in society is being accelerated on Facebook.
Support for Decoder comes from Squarespace. Squarespace is an all-in-one platform you can use to build a website and help people find your ventures. Whether you're seeking a location for your podcast, teaching language classes, or selling handcrafted ceramics, Squarespace has all the tools you need to create a home on the web. You can create a polished, professional place that connects people with whatever it is you're excited about. Squarespace also supports all forms of connecting with those people, whether you're selling products online or in person, or offering memberships. You can make your website look exactly how you want it. They even have tools to help you create a custom logo. And they make it easy to create a place for people to schedule an appointment with you, browse your services, or learn more about why you do what you do. Visit squarespace.com/decoder for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code DECODER to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Support for this podcast comes from Hims. It can be challenging for men to speak about their health, and whether that's a fear of being vulnerable or just wanting to keep things private, there are just some things we would just rather keep to ourselves. Hims knows how you feel, which is why they're looking to provide you the help you need discreetly. Hims is a men's healthcare brand looking to provide simple and convenient access to science-backed treatments for men. The entire process is 100% online, so you can get a new routine of improving your overall health in private. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free and in discreet packaging. No waiting rooms and no pharmacy visits. So while it can be tough to deal with this part of your life, it doesn't mean you have to do it alone. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/decoder. That's hims.com/decoder for your personalized treatment options. hims.com/decoder. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See hims.com/decoder for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
We're back with a special episode of Decoder with Casey Newton talking to Nick Clegg, VP of Global Affairs at Facebook.
So let's turn to another really important subject that you write about in this piece, which is polarization. I think a lot of folks I talk to take for granted the idea that social networks accelerate what researchers call negative affective polarization, which is just basically the degree to which one group dislikes another. But as you point out in the piece, and I have done some writing on, the research here, while limited, is mixed. But I do think it strongly suggests that polarization at least has many causes, and some of those do predate the existence of social networks. At the same time, I think all of us have had the experience of getting on Facebook and finding ourselves in a fight over politics or observing one among friends and family. And we read the comments and everyone digs in their heels and it ends when they all unfriend each other or block each other. And so what I want to know is, do you feel that those moments just aren't collectively as powerful as they might feel to us individually? Or is there something else going on that explains Facebook's case that it is not a polarizing force?
Look, because as you quite rightly said, Casey, this is now such a, it's like almost a given. I just hear people literally just make throwaway remarks. Well, of course, social media is the principal reason for polarization. I mean, it's become a sort of settled sediment layer in the narratives around. So I believe you me, I'm trying to tread really carefully here, because when you interrupt people's narratives, repeat with gusto, folk don't like it. And that's why I very deliberately in the piece not cited anything that Facebook itself has generated. Though, of course, we do research, we commission research. This is all third-party research. And I choose my words very carefully. I say that the results of that research, that independent academic research, is mixed. It really is very mixed. And I think what we, in answer to your question, I think the reason perhaps why there is this dissonance now between the academic and independent research, which really doesn't suggest that social media is the primary driver of polarization after all, and the assumptions, I think there's a number of reasons. But it's partly one of geography. I mean, candidly, a lot of the debate is generated by people using social media amongst the coastal policy and media elites in the US. But, you know, let's remember, 9 out of 10 Facebook users are outside the US, and they have a completely different experience. They live a completely different world. And the Pew study in 2019, which is really worth looking at for those who are interested, you know, looked at people using social media in a number of countries, not least a number of countries in the developing world. And there they found overwhelming evidence that for them, for millions, perhaps billions of people in those countries who were not living through this, you know, peculiar political time in the US, they actually were using social media to experience people of different communities, different countries, different religions, different viewpoints on a really significant scale. I think there's geography. I think there's time. We just need to remember. You just need to look at the evidence, for which there is considerable evidence. And Stanford research published last year looked at that. They looked at 9 countries over 40 years and found that in many of those countries, polarization preceded the advent of social media. And in many other countries, polarization was flat or actually declined, even as the use of social media increased. So I think there's a issue of geography. There's an issue of time, where we're kind of candidly losing a little bit of sense of a perspective. And then I think there is just an issue of perhaps looking at social media in a way that is divorced from the other parts of the media ecosystem. And I've, to my mind at least, the study that was published just a few months ago by the I think it's called the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard University last year, and they looked specifically at election-related disinformation to do with mail-in ballots, because, you know, there was all this stuff circulating about mail-in ballots where, you know, a lot of folk were trying to sort of tarnish the integrity of using mail-in ballots. And they, you know, they showed pretty comprehensively that that was primarily driven by elite and mass media, not least cable news, and that social media only played a secondary role. So I think there's an issue of, we need perspective on geography, on time, and on outlet. And I think when you do that, I don't want to swing the other way. I don't want to somehow pretend that social media does not play a part in all of this. Of course it does. But I do hope I can make a contribution in saying, look, if we step back a bit, we're starting to reduce, almost, I think, simplistically, some quite complex forces that are driving cultural, socioeconomic, and political polarization in our society to just one form of communication.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. I'll also tell you my fear, though, which is that the best data about this subject, or a lot of it, is at Facebook. And I think there's a good question about whether Facebook even really has the incentive to dig too deeply into this. We know that when it has shared data with researchers in the past, it's you know, caused privacy issues. Cambridge Analytica, you know, essentially began that way. And yet this feels really, really important to me. So I'm just wondering, what are the internal discussions about research? Does the company feel like it maybe owes us more on that front? And is that something it's prepared to take on?
Yes, it does. And I personally feel really strongly about this. Of course, Cambridge Analytica, it's often forgotten, you know, was started by an academic legitimately accessing data and then illegitimately flogging that data on to Cambridge Analytica. And so, of course, that rocked this company down to, you know, right down to its foundations. And so, of course, that has led to a slightly rocky path in terms of creating a channel of by which Facebook can provide researchers with data. But I strongly agree with you, Casey, that these are issues which are not only important to Facebook, they're important to, they're societally important. I just don't think we're going to make progress unless we have more data, more research, independently vetted, so that we can have a kind of mature and evidence-based debate. Look, I do think we're getting a lot better. You know, the time I've been here, you know, I really believe we're starting to shift the dial. Last year, we provided funding to, I think, over 40 academic institutions around the world looking at misinformation and polarization. We've helped launch this very significant research project into the use of social media in the run-up to the US elections last year. Hopefully, those researchers will start providing the fruits of their research during the summer of this year. We've made available to them unprecedented amounts of data. There are always going to be pinch points where we feel that researchers are, in effect, scraping data, where we have to take action. And candidly, we're legally and duty-bound, not least under our FTC order, to do so. I hope we can handle those instances in a kind of grown-up way, whilst at the same time continuing to provide data in the way that you describe. I would really hope, Casey, that if you and I were to have this conversation in a year or so, you and I be able to point to data which emanates from Facebook, but has been freely and independently analyzed by academics in a way that has not been the case in recent years.
Let's do that. I'm going to mark my calendar so that we can do that. And another point in your essay that I think is worth talking about is you acknowledge something that I also think gets lost in some of the discussions that we have on these subjects, which is that the internet is bigger than four companies. And in the context of, you know, writing about, you know, sort of bad content elsewhere, you write, consider the presence of bad and polarizing content on private messaging apps, iMessage, Signal, Telegram, WhatsApp, used by billions of people around the world. Facebook, of course, owns WhatsApp, but not those others. Where do you think that sort of private messaging and maybe encrypted messaging fits into some of these conversations that we're having?
Well, I mean, look, the point I was making was that for those who believe it's, and I, you know, of course I'm caricaturing now just for brevity's sake, but for those who sort of say it's all the algorithm's fault, it's all the system's fault, and us human beings are just like puppets on a string, we're being manipulated. I just thought it was worth in passing pointing to the fact that actually billions of people use messaging apps as their primary form of communication, which is algorithm free, and yet it's still a route, a conduit by which unpleasant, polarizing, hateful content is spread. I do think that, you know, we've seen this on our own surfaces. You, in very general terms, you're seeing this big shift from people congregating, communicating, connecting with each other in open spaces, Instagram and Facebook, and doing so increasingly in more, you know, intimate settings, messaging apps. I think the vast majority, I think well over 90% of, you know, WhatsApp messages, I need to check this, but are still one-to-one messages. It's you know, Mark Zuckerberg has talked in the past about the sort of comparing them to the public square on the one hand and the kind of living room on the other. I do think people are increasingly expecting as sort of just table stakes, just as default entitlement to be able to communicate with others in a private and secure way through messaging. And I think that does then pose issues with regulators and policymakers. Yes, partly perhaps about the content in terms of, you know, standards of speech, hateful speech and so on. But actually, the more harder-edged side of that is the debate around law enforcement and just the impact that enforcement has on traditional forms of content-driven law enforcement. And that's something that companies like Facebook, you know, we work tirelessly with law enforcement to demonstrate that there are ways in which we can still enhance safety, even if we don't and nobody else has access to to message content. But it's definitely, you know, you can see this debate in India, you can see it in the UK, you can see it in the FBI director has recently talked about this publicly. I think that is a running theme, and we need to play a responsible role in striking the right balance between, I mean, it's an age-old debate, isn't it? This balance between privacy and security. It's, you know, from the days that letters were being steamed open, that this has always been a balance that we've had to try and strike in the right way in democratic societies.
I want to go back to a point you raised earlier about one of the biggest debates that I think we're having around social networks, which is who deserves to have a platform? And when somebody is removed from the platform, who gets to decide? You write, should a private company be intervening to shape the ideas that flow across its systems above and beyond the prevention of serious harms? To my mind, the answer is clearly yes. I think that companies have that right. I don't even know that companies would work if they were not able to go beyond, you know, simply removing illegal content. So I wanted to press you a bit on that point. Is that really the kind of call or the right to make that call? Is that something that Facebook would really want to give up?
No. So I agree with you. Of course, it's part and parcel, isn't it, of running a service that people voluntarily use. We are entitled to say you use our services, but if you do, there are certain rules of the game, and if you transgress them, if you do that most egregiously, you won't be welcome in using them again. I think, candidly, where it gets, just as a matter of first principle, a lot more tricky is when we as a private company make those adjudications about people who are, you know, democratically elected leaders or leaders of governments. I mean, obviously, the indefinite suspension of Donald Trump's page is the most obvious example of that, but just over the last few days, we've suspended President Maduro, his use of his page for 30 days. And that is really tricky. And you know, when you have, in response to the Trump suspension, when you have everyone from the president of Mexico to Bernie Sanders saying that they're worried about the precedent that sets, I kind of think it's reasonable for all of us to acknowledge that we're now entering into pretty tricky territory. And I guess the thing I would say to those people who said, you know, because there are a lot of people who said when we took that action against Trump, oh, you should have done this years ago, as if it was just an easy, straightforward decision to just suspend the elected president of the United States, you know, the most powerful democracy on the surface of the planet. It is not easy. That is not an easy decision. And I would be very, very worried if companies, and I say this as an ex-politician as much as now an executive of Facebook, I would be exceptionally worried if private companies in Silicon Valley just took a trigger-happy approach to that kind of thing, because that seems to me to be really blurring the boundaries between democratic principles and private prerogatives. And so that's, of course, one of the reasons why we have referred that case to the Oversight Board. I think they're busy looking at it now. I think they have to, under the rules of the Oversight Board, they have to, you know, come out with a pronouncement on whether they think we took the right decision and how we should move forward. Because we've asked them for wider guidance beyond the Trump case on how we should treat these issues and what happens when you have political leaders and when we want to take action against them. I hope they're going to pronounce fairly shortly. But we're doing that because we realise that, you know, this is a power we can wield, but it's a power which must, you know, must and should and can only be wielded in a way that is proportionate, careful, thoughtful, and accountable.
Yeah. And you know, I've been somebody who has been supportive of the Oversight Board because the status quo before the Oversight Board was that ultimately Mark Zuckerberg would just make every hard call, which, you know, is not a role that I think that he wanted or that, you know, many people thought was ideal. You know, at the same time, there is now this other board, which is not super accountable to anybody, that is going to be making this very consequential decision. I actually think we're going to see in the next few days, they're probably going to issue a ruling on Trump, is what I have been led to understand. Stand.
There you go. They're so independent, Casey, that you knew that before I did. I'm just going to scribble a quick note to my team.
Yeah, so look out for that. But I just wonder, like, so, you know, this board has been stocked with people who are big, you know, speech advocates. They have overturned most of the decisions that you've referred to them so far. There's a lot of speculation that they are going to overturn this one. What will it mean for Facebook if the board restores Donald Trump?
Well, it's sort of technically and narrowly, if they say, Facebook, thou shalt restore Donald Trump, then that is what we will do, because we have to, because we're duty-bound to do so. We've been very, very clear at the outset that the Oversight Board is not only independent, but its content-specific adjudications are binding on us. Beyond that, as I said, I know, of course, that the decision they make about Trump will grab all, quite rightly, the headlines, but I actually hope that actually their wider guidance on what we should do going forward in analogous, similar cases will be as if, you know, if not more significant, because we're trying to grapple with where we should intrude in what are otherwise quintessentially political choices, and we're anxious for their guidance. And on those, that guidance, that's guidance. Those will be recommendations, and we will then. Cogitate on that guidance ourselves, and then provide our own response over a period of time. But in terms of the specific up or down decision, that is something, you know, assuming that they're going to be clear one way or another, where we will have to abide by their decision. And it doesn't mean, of course, that our rules in terms of violations, strikes, and all the rest of it, they will remain in place. But I mean, our hands quite deliberately and explicitly are tied as far as specific individual content decisions that they make are concerned.
Let me ask you one final question. You write about how Facebook is rethinking about, you know, how it can use ranking changes, some of the other tools that we've discussed, to ensure that it has a positive impact on society. A lot of folks I know, I think, have given up on the idea that Facebook can have a positive impact on society. What I want to know is, what things can Facebook do that would make you believe, that would make Facebook believe, or that would make the world believe that it's having a positive impact on society? How would you measure that? How would you know it if you saw it?
Well, look, I don't want to sound glib, but I kind of think we see it all the time. I mean, why would 3 billion people in the world freely choose to use these services if it was bad for them? I mean, of course, there are bad actors who try to use any form of communication and, you know, have done so from time immemorial, from radio to television to letters to emails. And we need to go after them. We need to kick them off where we can. We need to make our systems better and so on. But I do, you know, it's the point I made earlier. I just do hope, even as we grapple with the minority of people trying to propagate bad content, we remember that the vast, vast, vast majority of, you know, people use Facebook for positive, sometimes playful, innocent, meaningful, joyful reasons, or just downright useful reasons. Why are millions and millions of small businesses using Facebook to reach customers in a way that they never could before? Isn't it remarkable? I think it's a great democratizing thing, economically speaking, that small businesses now have access to tools on Facebook to reach their customers in a way that only big corporates with big fat marketing budgets used to in the past. I think it's wonderful that whether you're a student in Guatemala or a sheep shearer in the outback in Australia or a fancy well-paid lawyer in New York, you can use Instagram and Facebook on exactly the same basis. I think that's an extraordinary equitable thing. So look, so I, for me, and I realize this might be an unfashionable thing to say to some, it is to me self-evident that Facebook is being used in really positive, creative and enriching ways. What I equally, however, acknowledge is that not only are there lots of legitimate concerns, we need to do more to lift the veil on how the system works, to give people more controls. What I set out in this piece is just to start on a renewed journey where Facebook really wants to kind of put people more in charge so they can in effect create and curate their own news feed. And we will make a number of announcements in the coming months, greater transparency on how we use survey evidence, how we demote, what signals we use, what more controls over content we can give to people. And look, I hope over time that as this pendulum has swung so dramatically from the tech utopianism and the tech euphoria of the past to what is now, in some cases at least, an almost hysterical tech pessimism, and neither extremes, I think, are right. I mean, it's always somewhere in the middle. I hope that that pendulum can come to rest and that one of the ingredients in creating a kind of a more kind of sustainable way forward is that users feel that they're more in charge, and that's the spirit in which I've written this piece.
Very good. Well, Nick Clegg, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Casey. Thanks very much.
So, Casey, that was a great conversation. What's your big picture takeaway on how Facebook is positioning itself?
To me, that last question is the most important one. How are we going to decide whether we think Facebook on net is a good thing for the world, whether social networks, whether any product like this that is driven by recommendations, algorithms, big data can actually improve society rather than tear it apart? And I think you hear that the company is still fumbling for an explanation toward that. You know, other companies just kind of make the case for themselves. Even if you think Amazon's labor practices are terrible, you probably like Amazon Prime. You might have questions about Apple's App Store policy, but gosh, you love your iPhone. Facebook doesn't have that. And so it's always in a position of trying to fight for public reputation and often finds itself in a position where it's hard to win that battle. So I think they've just got to figure out how can they make it self-evident for that Facebook is good for the world if in fact it is.
Yeah. And to me, I keep coming back to the question of, are they too big to have a point of view, to take a stand and say, this is what we are and this is what we're going to be, at a scale that demands that everyone will always want them to be everything? And that, is, to me, is it will forever be the question that sort of guides, as you called them, their contortions as they talk about how they moderate.
Yeah. I mean, the original idea of Facebook was that we would bring the world closer together and the world would just get better as a natural consequence of that. And now I think folks have real questions about that. And it is odd that there aren't more examples of like big groups coming together on Facebook to do good, you know, outside the level of like a community group or some kind of fundraiser.
Well, that was a great conversation. Thanks again to you, Casey. Thanks to Nick Clegg for this conversation and being on Decoder. Casey, you write Platformer, which is a newsletter about social networks and democracy. Do you want to tell people about it and where they can find it?
Yeah. And of course, I started this newsletter, you know, while at The Verge full time. And every day I try to explore the collisions between these companies as they're exploring the exact kind of questions that I was talking with Nick about today. So if you want to hear more of those conversations and get caught up on all of the news that unfolds in that domain every day, you can sign up at platformer.news and you can get at least one column for free every week.
As always, we'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can email us at decoder@theverge.com. You can hit us up directly. I'm at Reckless on Twitter. Casey is at Casey Newton on Twitter. If you like the show, please share it with your friends. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Decoder is a production of The Verge and part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Sophie Erickson and Andrew Marino. Our music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We'll see you next time.